This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio here on NPR One.
I'm Tom Wilmer reporting from Greensboro, North Carolina.
I'm Dennis Quaintance. We're at the Proximity Hotel, which is built 10 years ago in Greensboro, North Carolina.
Are you local boy? How did you wind up here?
Well, 40 years ago, actually, just back in April, it was 40 years, I wound up here because a good friend of mine, Bill Sherrill, who is from Winston-Salem, asked me to come back and help him open a restaurant. I was 21 at the time. But we met in Missoula, Montana. I grew up in western Montana, and I started working in a hotel there when I was 15 years old. So I've been in the playing this game ever since.
So you start out front desk or whatever in Montana, and one day something happens, and you're a hotelier. You own a hotel, not only A, but two.
Well, yeah. Actually, I started in housekeeping. I was not a housekeeper, but a housekeeper's assistant. An amazing thing, you know, welcome to America. You show up and have some enthusiasm and you're curious and people will give you opportunities. It's really true.
As I travel around America today, employers and people like you, if somebody shows up, they show up on time and every day you're going, oh my God, management material.
Oh yeah. I really think that one of the biggest things to having a joyful career is to not worry about what's not fair in any given moment or something like that, but just focus on what the real intention is. And the intention that we've articulated for our business and what I've figured out real early in my career is cause the guests to be pleased to be here. And then the only way you can do that is to work with people that want to be here. If you do those two things, then you're probably going to be able to pay the bills.
In your life, it wasn't a simple journey.
No.
So how do you wind up working front desk to owning front desk?
Well, yeah, and to be clear, you know, in terms of the owning, I have partners on the hotel side, and then the operating companies, the restaurant and the hotel management company, are now employee-owned. Just 2 years ago, we made them employee-owned.
I heard about that, and I really want you to deconstruct that in the why, in the benefits.
So starting back how I ended up here, and they sort of tie together, because one of the things I noticed early on in my, you know, being around restaurants and hotels, is that if everyone was playing team ball, if there was legitimate camaraderie where you're really trying to get something done together, we almost always did better when things were goofed up and there were two people that called out drunk or something and, you know, you had to deal with it. So what I decided is I really wanted to work in a places where people had aligned interests. They all wanted
a sense of ownership by default.
That's right. It's a sense of camaraderie and it kind of comes with it. In fact, you know, I see your Air Force hat, and I think that it's either war or sports where people really come together with camaraderie. But I thought, why can't we do that like on Tuesday? And so you can't do that and accomplish that with a bunch of cheerleading. You have to do it with a context that people experience as authentic.
So again, rewinding in your life.
Yeah.
What was that process of going from A to B for you? What were you doing and how did you?
Really, what happened for me is that when I graduated from high school, I just became determined to figure out how to make a life for myself. I did not think I had money to go to college. I'm sure now I could have figured it out. So I just got a little bit scared, and fear's not a bad energizer as long as you don't get an ulcer. So I started reading a lot, and one of the best things that I did is figured out that you've got to know the vocabulary. And I had this sense, and it serves me well, that if you just focus on taking care of the guests and your colleagues, then things are going to work out. So the way that it sort of unfolded is I decided I wanted work in a lot of different hotels to learn a lot. So I went to Phoenix and worked in a business hotel, went to Palm Beach and worked at the Breakers. And, you know, you can get a job.
Right.
And once you get a job, you can learn a lot if you just wander around, help people, and then they turn around and help you. So that's how it sort of unfolded. And when Bill asked me to move back to North Carolina and help him open this restaurant 40 years ago, I was all in. I mean, who else? 21 years old doesn't have a credential of any sort as asked to be a general manager of a restaurant at that age. So it was a real opportunity.
Interesting. So again, restaurant to hotel here. How did that come about?
Well, I knew that hotels cost a lot of money. So, and restaurants and hotels are closely linked. And so my good friend and partner, Mike Weaver, and my wife, Nancy King Quaintance, and he partnered up and started a restaurant company 30 years ago. It was called Quaintance Weaver, and we started with this Lucky 32 restaurant in Greensboro. And now we have two. There's one in Cary as well. And so once we were in the restaurant business for 10 years, we sort of built up enough credibility out in the world that we could finance a hotel, so we did. But we're very cautious. We're the reluctant entrepreneurs. We put in a whole lot of equity capital rather than borrowing money. Mm-hmm. I mean, I always say your banks are your friends through thick.
So the process of building this hotel, somebody told me that this is basically a reuse structure, that you didn't build it from the ground up, and it's... Is that true?
No, I love this, though, because here's the idea, is we desperately wanted to find a mill to adapt and reuse as a hotel. We couldn't find one in a location that made any sense, so we decided that we would design the mill we would like to have found. Uh-huh. So we had sort of a parallel design ethos going, and one was, let's design a 1939 cut-and-sew factory, because they needed bigger windows for a lot of good natural light, and we found frames of references for that. And at the same time, we did the what we call the adaptive reuse design, and we pretended on that side of it that we had this lead designer that was an amalgam of Ray and Charles Ames, Ariel Saarinen, and David Hicks.
So you guys compromised all over the place.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, what I found is that the best thing is in a design process or in all this kind of stuff is just be an eighth grader.
Yeah.
Go be silly.
Right.
I mean, you know, go ahead and do things like brush your teeth. I mean, do the practical stuff. Mm-hmm. But still, stay playful.
Yeah.
And we like the idea of saying, you know, we can be pragmatic and idealistic, but not at exactly the same moment. You got to oscillate between the two.
So again, in that whole mix, you guys decided to go 110% from a design function standpoint, from an energy efficiency, from the lead world. Tell us why you did that and what you did, because you, again, went to the extreme without compromise.
Oh, yeah. It's really interesting. This is the first U.S. Green Building Council's Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design LEED rating system. The highest rating is platinum, and then certified is the base level rating. They're sort of ranked. I always say certified is a chihuahua, and platinum is a great dane. They're all dogs, but it's just mm-hmm. different levels.
Yeah.
And we ended up at platinum, not because we were really trying to, but we just wanted to avoid hypocrisy. You know, 7 or 8 years before we started this design project, Nancy, my bride, showed up pregnant with these boy-girl twins. So when we started working on this, we said, you know, hey, we're going to have a legacy if we want it or not. What do we want people after we're dead to say about us? And we just said, well, we don't want them to hate our guts, you know, because we're apathetic about using resources. So we just decided we'd be sincere about considering what we could accomplish, but we did not have any specific goals. I think that's how you get in trouble. But what we found when we started working on all this, that not only was there low-hanging fruit, but there was fruit that I like to say that was literally lying on the ground that was perfectly harvestable.
Mm-hmm. An example?
Oh, for instance, like these elevators generate electricity when they break. I mean, why would you waste the energy of breaking an elevator just as heat? Why not capture it and use it as electricity? I mean, duh. I mean, they did it with streetcars, you know, 100 years ago, and mm-hmm. not the cable cars, but the streetcars in San Francisco used to do that, and they might still. But anyway, we can do it with a Toyota Prius. We can do it with a darn elevator. So we have the first elevator in the country that does that.
An energy-generating source for
yeah,
you?
Yeah, yeah.
And has that taken off? Do you find that more often?
You know, the problem with all of this would be so much further distributed out into the world if there was sort of a more of a price incentive for energy cost. And
well, we're going the opposite way with that. I heard some of the tax benefits for solar just went away yesterday.
Oh, you know, it's really crazy. We ought to do whatever we can to lead. You know, we've led with smartphones and we've led with personal computing thing. We ought to lead with this energy thing because it's inevitable. And to sort of shut down innovation doesn't really make sense to me. Here's another example. It's just so simple, but, you know, the sun shines a lot here. And so why not harvest the sun in the form of hot water if you need hot water? So we get most of our hot water for free. About 60% comes from the sun.
Do you have panels? How do you...
We have 100 panels on the roof, and it's a simple thing. There's hardly any moving parts. All it is copper tubing with little flanges and a couple of pumps, and you have a heat exchanger. It's like a doggone radiator on an old Studebaker. I mean, there's nothing complicated about this. I really think that a lot of the energy stuff that we did here that is really efficient, you could have done in the World War II era technology, but rather than having a computer decide how to adjust some valves and that sort of stuff, you'd have just had a person with a clipboard that would looked at the temperatures and the flow rates and twisted a valve.
It's that simple.
It's that simple. Yeah. I mean, there's nothing that you go, oh, whiz, bang, that's so cool, cutting edge.
In that design process and that dreamer process, you made some choices that cost you a premium.
Yeah.
So have you tracked and deconstructed the payback benefits of all those premiums that you did that people were probably going, is he wasting money here?
Yeah. Well, we spent about $3 million more than we might have otherwise. And we had
a question at the time.
Yeah, well, the good news is when you go in with a lot of equity, the banks don't bug you.
Right.
And my partnership group are just wonderful people, and they knew that I was really focused and I wasn't going to get too idealistic on them. No, we really didn't have second thoughts about it, but we would have 10 years later if we hadn't got our money back. But we had our money back in less than 4 years. Between energy savings, water actually cost money too, and water savings. But also there was at the time some tax credits for the solar panels.
So going forward, it's revenue generating in a sense for you, that premium that you invested.
Oh, absolutely. It cuts our operating costs, but it also gives us a bit of a credential out in the world. If you're a meeting planner and your organization or your company has a green initiative, then, having this green credential causes us to get on their radar.
So right now we're in the Proximity Hotel, and the name Proximity One came from?
Oh, it's a wonderful story. Greensboro has got a wonderful, rich history, and one of the rich parts of it is this family called the Cones, Moses and Caesar Cone, quite the handles, moved here and started a textile company that became the largest manufacturers of denim in the world here, and the original company was called Proximity because it was the proximity to the raw materials, cotton and the like, and transportation and all that.
And is that the legacy of Lee Wrangler?
Oh, no, Ed, that's a
whole different.
Well, there is a bit of a tie-in because they started off as Bluebell Overhaul Company. And in fact, our little garden here is called Bluebell. But Bluebell and became Wrangler and Lee and all that dovetailed into them.
Does Lee Wrangler still manufacture here?
No, I do not believe they manufacture in Greensboro, but they do all of their design and
corporate is here?
Oh, yeah, corporate's here. It's a great company, and it's really kind of cool, especially growing up west because everyone wore Wranglers. I mean, that was the...
Yeah, the Wrangler butt.
Yeah, that's right. And they're more comfortable. There's less... Well, we better not go there. But they're really good jeans. So anyway, yeah, it's a great part of the community having this.
So you are paying homage to those roots.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, to the denim roots, which indirectly relate to Wrangler and Lee, and also directly to the cotton fabrics that were made here. Not just denim, but we also were one of the larger manufacturers of flannel.
Okay, so there's more than just Proximity. I assume that O'Henry, your second property, came second?
No, actually, we built the O'Henry first.
Okay.
It was about 20 years
ago. Oh, interesting.
Yeah. And O'Henry, the short story writer, came along in Greensboro. Interesting stories about him. And he went west to Austin, Texas when he was...
I was going to say, because that's the context I know him. You have a little tour of his office
Yeah. And we have a bunch of O'Henry stuff here, too. He's an interesting guy. The lore is that he could write with one hand and draw simultaneously with the other hand. Who knows? I mean, truth is overrated if that's true. But
I believe it.
Yeah.
I do.
He was a talented guy. So the original O'Henry Hotel in Greensboro was built in 1919. In fact, I even have the speech that O'Henry's biographer gave just 9 years after he died that the hotel opened. And so we pretended when we built the O'Henry
So you were ground up. This was a new incarnation of...
Yeah, exactly. It was a new incarnation of the O'Henry. Mm-hmm. With all of our impressive progress that we make as Americans, we tore down the 1919 building.
Of course.
Yeah, so it was unfortunate because it was a cool building. Hindsight's 2020, I guess. So we pretended there like the original architect of the O. Henry, a guy named Charles Hartman was our architect there. So all of our design work comes out of fantasy.
So you were paying homage to?
To the original Henry and to the original designer of it. And we really pretended like it was 1919, but we could employ in that era 1998 technology. Mm-hmm.
Both properties have on-site eateries, right? You have a dining facility.
Oh, yeah. The O. Henry has the Green Valley Grill, and here it's the Printworks Bistro, which was another mill owned by the Cones. We named it in honor of that.
And somebody that I was talking to in town yesterday, I mentioned the proximity, and they go, oh, my God, they have one of the top restaurants in town. So is that true? And you have that almost standalone allure where people will come here never stay at the hotel.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. In fact, most of the time people say, I'm just going to Printworks. They don't even think about the O. Henry. Mm-hmm. I mean, the proximity, they just sort of have to drive past it to get a parking place. Yeah, that's the whole idea. I mean, if you look back at the era when I was coming along in hotel business, the restaurants and hotels were not good.
It was the opposite.
Yeah, but they sucked.
Tell us a little bit more about the hotel and the LEED environmentals that people are most impressed with and you're most proud of.
Well, I'm most proud that folk don't notice. You know, in fact, only a couple of years after we opened, there was a designer staying here, and I ran into her. She had been here almost a week and said, I hope you're enjoying your stay. And she said, oh, I really enjoyed the style and all that. And I said, and that we were able to do that and be the first LEED Platinum hotel in the country. And she said, oh, I had no idea this was an environmental hotel. And I said, exactly, because, you know, deprivation ain't sustainable. So it isn't about depriving a human being of any creature comfort. I mean, it's a hotel, for goodness sakes. So that's what I'm most excited about, is that people stay here and they don't know. How do you know that the hot water was heated with the sun rather than natural gas? I mean, we don't brag about it too much.
So give me some other examples. And again, I find it fascinating listening to you that it's such a win-win. Looking in from the outside, one would assume you're paying this premium, a huge premium, where there, other than perception, there might not be payback.
The problem with people not doing more of this is literally the way we do our books and the way we do our taxes is that it's that first cost or development cost are separated so greatly from operating cost. But we were the developer and the operator. We're like proprietors. We have a different word. Mm-hmm. And so we had a different long-term mindset, so operating costs matter to us.
Some of it's theoretical. I mean, you have your pro forma, and you're projecting visually on paper into the future.
Yeah.
So in some ways, you couldn't have really known.
Yeah.
You could have hoped, right?
No, you're exactly right. If we'd have done all of this, and we wouldn't have had energy savings or we had goofed it up and people weren't comfortable staying here because the energy efficient mm-hmm. stuff didn't cause people to be comfortable. They were stuffy at night or something like that. It would have been a train wreck. I mean, you know, I'm a nervous cat. I mean, I think we're all nervous. I tell everyone that fear is a sign of intelligence. Just don't get an ulcer. So, yes, we were scared. I'm on the radio. I need to be careful. We were scared. But it worked out. And right. I think one of the reasons that it worked out is that we were scared. Mm-hmm. We really went deep with all this stuff. We didn't just get, you know, sort of drunk with our idealism. We balanced it with a lot of pragmatism.
What are some of the key things that you did that you are most proud of?
There's some silly ones like these urinals, you know, that don't take water. Well, there's all kinds of waterless urinals, but those of us that have some experience with urinals know that most of them stink and they have this problem I call splashback. It's terrible. So we really found one that didn't do those two things. We tested like 6 or 8 urinals. The same with these commodes.
What brand of urinal did you end up using?
Oh, it's a Kohler.
Uh-huh. And
you know what? Kohler makes the best everything.
It's unbelievable.
Yeah, I even went up to Kohler and hung out with those guys. In fact,
the grandson, whatever, he's still...
It's David Kohler.
Yeah, he's right there, 80-something.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, it's a great company. In fact, they needed to really test to make sure that these urinals worked well. But how do you do that? So they invented a robot, and they called it the Urinator 6000. But even like their commodes and their Kohler, too, they're 1.1 gallon as opposed to 1.6 gallon flush, but they really flush.
It's like a power flush. It just blows my mind how efficiently it works.
And it's so smart because water weighs something, right? Mm-hmm. So they fill the tank with probably, 4 gallons of water, but you only use 1 point.
Right. So that gives it the pressure head.
Yeah, so it gives it a pressure head. And plus, it rather than having a flapper, it's got a little pipe in there that lifts up. So the water just goes out in like 1.8 seconds. I'm making that up. But it really kind of clears the bowl. But anyway, what I love is that, you know, a lot of stuff that's considered sustainable ain't sustainable because it's either ugly or it's going to break down in 2 months and stuff like that. But these things are, they're really more durable. I mean, flappers in a conventional toilet goof up all the time.
And that's your primary weak point in a toilet, yeah, is right. So the $1.98 flapper.
Yeah, right. And here we have no flappers. Yeah. It's really interesting that sort of the sexy stuff that we did here is not sexy. Mm-hmm. But we did do, you know, obviously the solar panels I mentioned, but I also really love that in the kitchens, you're exhausting all kinds of air that you don't need to a lot of the time. You only need to exhaust a lot of air when there's a lot of heat you're trying to get rid of or a lot of smoke. Right. So we have these sensors. They're little laser sensors that shoot through there and notice it. The exhaust from the kitchen goes down by about 60% up to like 75% mm-hmm. down from what it would be normally when there's not a lot of heat or smoke, which just makes a whole lot of sense. That's complicated a little bit because you've got to tie that in with the makeup air and all the air conditioning. But if you're running that thing full tilt bozo all the time, you're exhausting all kinds of air that you've already sort of burnt the coal to air condition, and then you're exhausting it. It's stupid. So these things, that sounds simple too, but it really is a neat feature. And there's a wonderful byproduct to it is that when you're in there doing the prep work in the morning, normally you're just sitting in there. It's like being in a buzzing factory because the exhaust hoods are loud. But it's like being at home. You know, it's a quiet environment when it's not busy. It's really cool.
I know that central for you to qualify that level has a lot to do with materials.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. A material one that's interesting. This building is almost all concrete. I mean, it is, you know, there's some rebar in it and all that. So we found out that we could use the sort of cleaned up version of coal ash in there. I thought it would be a premium. Actually, it was a decrease in price because the coal companies will give it to the concrete manufacturers for free and deliver it.
To get rid of it.
Yeah, yeah. And so, and it's perfectly safe. I tease all the time. I mean, I go lick our columns if you want. I mean, I'm not going to get sick. It's a wonderful way to reuse. That's what we need to figure out is that rather than throwing stuff away or dealing with it, you know, floating down in some river or something with this coal ash, let's put some of it into building materials. Mm-hmm. To be fair, and I want to be clear, is not all coal ash can work in building materials, but some percentage of it can.
Right. An additive.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, but it takes up, I think there's 700,000 pounds, if I remember correctly. Mm-hmm. I'd need one to look that up, but yeah. There's a boatload of coal ash here. And, you know, hopefully if we run this business well, that no one's going to knock this thing down. And in other words, this will be in place, hopefully, for hundreds and hundreds of years.
And then soft goods, materials, it extends there. Your carpeting,
oh, yeah.
Everything qualifies or disqualifies.
That's exactly right. Well, LEED is a really smart program. And, you know, there's several categories that they want you to consider, and including what we're talking about now. And they have different sort of qualification rankings. And one of the things that we did with the actual soft goods, like the furniture that we're sitting in, that doesn't cross over into LEED, the actual furnishings that go into it. But most all of this furniture is made by friends of ours. I mean, we're living in a furniture hotbed. In fact, most of the guest room furniture is made by a fellow that worked with us a while as a waiter.
How about carpeting? That's another big one.
Yeah, we use Mohawk's, Durkin's part of Mohawk, and they're really doing a great job. In fact, we're doing some new carpeting over. We did it here and over at the O'Henry soon, and all of it will be recycled. They send
so is that part of the qualification of your carpet qualifying?
Yeah, well, some of these soft goods are harder for them to qualify. Yes, there are criteria for that, but recycling it is a good idea. I will admit that with carpet, there is a premium that we pay for it, but we found that to be palatable because there's a price to avoiding hypocrisy.
Mm-hmm. Maybe there's a payback in durability?
Well, yeah. First of all, their carpet is really good, but the payback, I believe, is in sincerity, in that if you end up being the first LEED Platinum hotel in the country, and then once you open it, you're apathetic about how you do your operations, then there's probably a certain place in a not too comfortable place, like hell, where you should end up. And so our idea is let's avoid this hypocrisy by maintaining the sort of ethos that got us here.
Anything else that you can think of that you're most proud of in the LEED world that you did?
The indoor air quality is a really big part of it because that's a real conflict with LEED because you kind of get credit for having higher levels of oxygen, which is sort of the inverse of high CO2. but it takes energy to do that. Mm-hmm. So we put a lot of work and a lot of engineering into how we could bring in, it's hot in North Carolina a lot, how we could bring in outside air, temper it, and dehumidify it. It's a very simple thing, but we use the thermal energy for the air that we exhaust, and we capture that thermal energy and give it to the air we bring in. So I think that's the coolest thing ever. And I love going up there and showing it, because these doggone air handling units are big enough that when you need to turn them off first, but the ducts are big enough I can stand in them.
Okay, the world is not perfect, as we know, and dreams don't always work out as we like. In your process, in this journey, did you have any oops moments?
yeah, we did. Like, for instance, early on, we thought, boy, this bamboo is such a great material. It's going to be great because, you know, everyone knows all the nice things about bamboo. But we were this close to using bamboo in a number of conditions. And I'd always like to go to the other side of what's on the internet and find people that are arguing against it. And I discovered that bamboo is very good as a vertical surface, but not as a horizontal surface. It delaminates, it's hard, there's problems with it. And we had only planned to use it on fluorescent counters, so there's not a piece of bamboo in here, even though I'm an advocate of bamboo for the walls. But like even the bottom of these desks, rather than there being particle board on it, it's called Plyboo. So there's
Plyboo is one of the first laminate bamboo companies in the whole industry, way back.
Yeah, I think it's a fabulous material. Yeah. So it's not evident that there's bamboo here, but we were careful. And that is a sort of an analogy for where I came up with this thing. And I don't speak Latin, so this probably isn't done right, but it's called caveat vertus emptor, and that is beware a green buyer. The idea is that, you know, a lot of this stuff that's sold as being sustainable is only sustainable to the people that are selling used pocketbook, you know, that some of it is sort of a hoax. Mm-hmm. So be careful. I mean, don't get cynical, but be your own advocate. Make sure that you're not buying something just to feel good about it that really doesn't have a long life cycle. Because if you do something that's completely made of recycled products and it lasts 3 weeks, what value is that?
Yeah, well, and then you have that multiplier.
Yeah.
How many rooms do you have?
Oh, yeah, 130 rooms. There's 125,000 square feet in this building. So if any mistake that we made would have just been amazing. Another one that I get a kick out of is the way we built the actual building. There's precast panels on the outside, and they're insulated on the inside. So there's a really good indoor air quality is a really big thing, and very often you have problems because there's exterior cavity walls, and we don't have exterior cavity walls, but yet we have a real good R rating because the precast panels are insulated, and the inside and the outside panels are held together with carbon fiber. This is a cool building.
Yeah, so you had fun.
I had a blast and continue to have a blast because it's an ongoing process. I feel like the luckiest guy in the world because, you know, I get to wake up in the morning and work on the fidelity of the sound systems and the playlist for the sound systems. And then, you know, how our energy recovery units are working and how the solar system's working. And then go down and you know, I got to try those short rib sliders, you know, just to make sure they taste good. So I got the greatest job in the world.
Yeah, doing your professional job.
Yeah, right.
I love it.
I would love to share a little bit about this idea of being employee-owned. You know, the operating company, the restaurants and the hotel, we have 670 staff members. In fact, we've even sort of expanded it some since we did the ESOP. We have a thing called Acquaintance Weaver Craft Guild that builds, like we built these tables sitting behind us. We designed them and built them. We have a design team.
Wow.
And a craft guild. So we have two studios that we do this work in. It's really fun. You know, that's just cast concrete and the metal frame below. And
so you weld all the parts together and everything?
Yeah, actually, we did the prototypes for this, and we found that there's a little welding shop here in town that could do it. You know, they have better, set up a jig and do it all. So we had asked them to do it. So it's Bybee's right out here on Swing Road.
That's really cool.
Yeah, it's really fun. So it's 3 years ago, my good friend and partner Mike Weaver and I sat down and talked and said, you know, what's the future of the ownership of this company? And figured out, I've studied it a long time, people get old and then they die, you know, so then their stock, you know, whatever they own, it's got to go somewhere. Yeah. So we wanted it to be somewhere where the idea, the foundational ideas for our company about, you know, I'm reluctant to talk about it because if someone says we're real careful about fairness and that kind of stuff, I feel like they're full of it. Mm-hmm. But that really is important to us, and it's a challenge all the time. So we didn't want to just have this company end up being sold to to some outfit that would run it like some corporation.
Cold and ruthless. Bean counters rule these days.
Oh, yeah. You know, and we're kind of ruthless. We really expect our guests to be getting taken care of, and we don't like it when someone says, well, you know, my dog was sick this morning, so I'm sad, so I'm not nice to people. We're like, that's malarkey. Come on. Mm-hmm. You know, but that's right. They end up making short-term decisions very often. It just isn't the ethos that we're grounded on.
Bottom line of you going in this direction, was there an altruistic thread of powering your employees?
Yep. Yep.
And it's kind of, it's a win-win.
Yep.
Because they feel ownership, then their attitude, like your the bad day that the person has, they're going to be less inclined to let that out.
Oh, yeah. We're, you know, anything that we do that causes a guest not to be happy is going to cause them not to come back, which means less revenue, which means less profit. Mm-hmm. And the opposite is true. So now our interests are 100% aligned because the company's actually owned by a trust, and no one ever puts money into it. They just gain participation as a beneficiary of the trust based on working here and how much they make divided by the total amount of payroll that year. It's simple as it can be.
Are there benefits for you as ownership, as corporate?
Yeah, we sold the business. We probably could have sold the business for more,
sure.
Almost assuredly.
Just put it on the market.
Yeah, we could have just sold it, but we didn't want to. That was the idea is that, you know, there are people here, even though our company's only 30 years old, there are people here that have been here 30 years. I'm one of them. But a lot of people that have been here 20 years and that kind of stuff. And the idea that, you know, 5 years from now or 15 years from now, that this would just be, you know, some brand name hotel, or it would break our hearts. Plus, it would be, we didn't think it was fair to the sincere efforts that our colleagues have made.
So now, what do the workers get tangibly? What are the benefits?
They get what's called, we call retirement units. The bottom line is that if you started here when you were in your mid-20s and you stayed until you were 65 and you started making $20,000 a year and you increased your pay by, this analogy is at 5% every year, and if 5% of your earnings went into this program, which is about what they're averaging now, then when you retired, you would have over $1 million in your account and you will not have put any money into it.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
So,
and this is interesting because that's at $20,000.
Yeah, that's mind-blowing. It obviously works. It's obviously working.
Yeah.
Why is this not replicated as a model in other companies more?
I think the simple answer to that is that folk that have jobs like mine don't know about it, mm-hmm. and they confuse it. They think that when they sell it, that they're gonna that there's gonna be what I call goofed up governance. But this thing is really well figured out. It's a fascinating model.
And where did the model come from? How did you find it?
In the late 1950s, this guy named Kelso, a Colorado kid that's bright, ended up as a lawyer out in California, an economist, thought that too much money was the earning power of capital was becoming so much more powerful than the earning power of labor, mm-hmm. that he was thinking, oh my gosh, what can we do so that we don't end up with this sort of lopsided society. Long story short, he worked with this newspaper company as a lawyer, and they wanted to sell to their employees, but they couldn't figure out how to do it unless they sold it to their own pension program. So Kelso got on an airplane, went to Washington, and got the head of the IRS to agree to let them borrow money within their pension program, which sounds crazy, mm-hmm. but they only borrowed the money to buy the company. And so it took all the way from the late 50s until 74 when it was actually introduced as legislation within the ERISA Act, the Employment Income Security Act of 1974. So since 74, it's been a model that exists, but it took quite a while to kind of get some of the bugs worked out of it. There was some silliness that some people took advantage of it. U.S. Steel, remember when they got everyone to make concessions. So there was some weirdness that went on for a while. But they fixed all those little mechanisms that were flawed. Now it's a wonderful model, particularly for companies like ours.
And again, why do I not read about it? Why do we not hear about it?
I think that there's not as many employee-owned, ESOP-owned companies because the people that have jobs like mine don't know about them, or if they do know about them, they are certain that they're right, but they're incorrect. Mm-hmm. They believed that there would be control issues. They believed that they'd sell their company for too low of a premium compared to what they can sell it for otherwise. And they believed that the debt that it will inherently have would mess up their ability to earn money, to borrow money otherwise. All those things are not true.
Proven that.
Oh, yeah. I proved it. I had to prove it to myself because I didn't want to be stupid. Right. But, yeah, it's proven by a lot of companies, like Davy Tree Company is employee-owned, Public Supermarkets is employee-owned. And it's astonishing because if you look at the performance within any industry, most of the top performing companies are employee-owned. But the problem is they only represent, I think it's less than 1% of the people employed in the private sector are employed by 100% employee-owned models.
That's so interesting because looking in from the outside, it's obvious. The big question is why would not more corporate entities go this way?
I really think it does come back to this just sort of lack of information. It's something that I'm really interested in helping with. Since we did this 3 years ago, there has been 8 CEOs that have come to me and said, what in the world did you do? And so I just tell them about it. And now 3 of those companies are employee-owned, and I think 2 more will be soon.
And again, looking in from the outside, listening to you and hearing about what you did, my first instinct is, didn't the guy kind of box himself out of a job?
Oh, me?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, no, actually, you know, it's interesting. My job, I feel even more obligated because if I made a mistake 4 years ago, it affected me and my family and my good friend and partner, Mike Weaver, and his family negatively. And if we did something well, then it accrued mostly to us. You know, there'd be some bonuses and stuff. But now, if we do something good, then it benefits 600 people. Mm-hmm. So it's a much different sort of thing. So I'm a little more...
But you are a part of that employee family now?
Yeah, my job didn't change it at all.
But you shift your title or your paperwork stuff changed a little bit, right?
Yeah, not for a whole lot. The only thing that really changed for me is that rather than Mike Weaver and I being the board of directors, now we have a board of directors that includes 2 members outside of our company. And I thought that would be sort of bureaucratic and a pain, and I love it. I mean, it's a really great...
Kind of fresh eyes, fresh perspective.
There's an advisory angle to it. There's an accountability angle. For me, I think that everything that has happened from where I'm sitting in my job has been positive, being CEO of an ESOP as opposed to being CEO of a privately held company.
Very fascinating. So we're probably talking about the future best hope of America in many respects.
You know, again, I wish I really knew the numbers, but I think it's like 1% of the people are employed by 100% ESOP employee-owned companies. I think if we could get that only to even like 10 or 15%, it could be transformative for the following reasons. One is that you would learn at the next level to play fair with others because you're all eating out of the same feed bucket. Another reason is that with the ESOP, even though your account might say you have $20,000 in your account, you can't go to your bank and borrow against it. You can't even pledge it. You can't even put it on your statement to borrow money from the bank because it's leveraged. It could go down. It's based on the value of the stock.
At that moment in time.
That's exactly right. So I think it pushes up financial literacy.
Kind of like real estate in that your house is only worth what you can sell it for when you sell it.
When you sell it. Yeah. So it's really, it's exactly the same sort of idea. So what I think will happen is that members of people's families and their neighbors will say, now, why is it this wonderful person that worked as a housekeeper at the proximity hotel has enough money to send their granddaughter to college, and I don't, and I had a job that paid more? And the answer would be the earning power of capital, because she was able to, you know, Einstein said the most powerful force in the universe is compound interest. So she was able to make compound interest work for her, not against her.
When you look back at your life, your 40-plus year career, what are you most proud of? Would it be... this would be part of it?
Yeah. The answer to that is I'm most pleased, and proud is sort of a tricky word because it can be...
egos.
It can be like materialism sort of thing. But what I'm most tickled by is that I've written a boatload of paychecks and not one of them's bounced because I've always been afraid of that.
All right. Well, I could keep you all day.
Yeah, I love it.
This has been fascinating. Parting words.
An idea that I think is really fun and I wish was more broadly distributed in this country is that grow where you're planted. You know, that's one of the biggest, hardest lessons that I had to learn is that it was always like you wanted to try to go do the next big thing. And for me, what's really been cool in our company and in my life is that we decided to replace the word maximum, which is sort of the American ethos, with the word optimum. And focusing on optimal experiences for ourselves and our guests. So we have 2 hotels and 4 restaurants. We could have more, but we think this is the size that is sort of optimal for getting the rubber to the road.
Dennis, thanks for sharing.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. Fun hanging out with you.
You too. Okay, Dennis, if somebody wanted to learn more about your company and, like, we talked about the employee-owned concept.
Oh, yes. There's websites. OHenryHotel.com will link you to QWRH, Quaintons Weaver Restaurants and Hotels. There's all these little family of sister restaurants, sister businesses, sort of links at the bottom. And within that, there's a section about employee-owned. And there's a lot of links to information about what I shared about the employee ownership model and about the LEED process and the U.S. Green Building Council and all that kind of stuff. So that's a good place to learn about all that. And there's some information. I write about some of this stuff in these things called Rambling that are on the link through the QWRH.com.
A blog site.
Yeah, it's sort of like a blog. But I would get kicked out of the blog game because I only do 2 a year. But anyway, I enjoy doing them. But I sort of ramble on about some of this stuff like employee ownership and environmental stewardship and buying food that is responsible, that sort of stuff. Oh, yeah, and my name is Dennis Quaintons, and you can find information on there about me and my family and all that there.
Dennis, thanks again for sharing.
Loved it.
I'm Tom Wilmer reporting from Greensboro, North Carolina. We'll see you here.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. Produced by California Central Coast NPR affiliate KCBX. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world. To learn more about Tom Wilmer's journeys around America and the world, log on to thomaswilmer.com.
Associate producers include Rebecca Nolan, Newfoundland, Canada, Molly Blaisdell, San Francisco, and Katya Singel, San Luis Obispo, California.
Underwriting support for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided in part by the Society of St. Vincent de Paul. People often associate the Society of St. Vincent de Paul with thrift stores. Donations like clothing, your gently used couch, or still serviceable washing machine generate funds to assist the Society in putting food on the table for people in need, or keeping the lights on and families in their homes. To find a St. Vincent de Paul thrift store in your area, visit svdpusa.org. Once again, svdpusa.org. And whether you're shopping for new or used items, donating them, or volunteering, you're helping the Society of St. Vincent de Paul help others.